Warning, content on this episode may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion advised. Trigger warning, this episode contains details of mental health issues, sexual abuse and substance abuse.
I was being abused sexually by some of the adults within the system. And they told me that, well, you're a liar, so nobody's ever going to believe you. Nobody's ever going to believe a single word you say. We all know you lie, so we can basically do what we want, and you can't do anything about it.
Hello, and welcome back to Season 2 of Unexpected Turns. With me, Anne Ibben.
And me, Bev Evans. And I can't wait for you to hear all the wonderful stories our guests have to share with you all.
First up, we have the amazing Jack Gregory. At the age of 8, his world was turned completely upside down.
And after which, despite a really strong work ethic and a desire to make money, Jack's life spiraled into a world of crime and violence.
But having served his time, he's keen to make amends. And now, in the best place ever, he talks to us.
So here is who and what has helped Jack Gregory turn his life around.
Good morning, Jack. We're delighted that you're here today with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We've talked a few times, so it's lovely to see you there in your garden shed, did you say?
It is. It's my garden shed. It's my little
man cave, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say man cave. It's my little sort of fortress of solitude away from five screaming kids at times.
You need that.
Well, apart from your five screaming kids, I'm sure they're not screaming now. I really wanted to talk a bit about you and your early life, because you've had a fascinating life, some major ups and downs, and you've written some poetry that really brought tears to my eyes. If you could just tell us a little bit about your backstory and what's happened, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah. So I grew up in a small mining town surrounded by four other mining towns, a place called Normanton in West Yorkshire, during Thatcher's Britain. And the problem was that a lot of people were losing their jobs. You're talking 1984, 1985.
Yeah.
Mines were being closed down. So this is a town that never really recovered. Even 40 years on, it's never really recovered. But my family, we weren't poor by any sort of standard. My dad was a civil engineer for British Rail. My mum was a social worker for social services.
Right, tough jobs.
Yeah, for the old people in the community. So they were well known in our community. Whereas most of the community was failing. Because my dad didn't work down a mine, he worked on the railways, we were kind of thriving. This was before, like, all the privatisation of British Rail.
Mm.
And I remember my first sort of real memory is on my 8th birthday, and I'd had a really good day full of cake and pop and good old Yorkshire platters, these five tier platters with all the cakes and stuff like that, and it was great. And I remember sitting on my mum's knee later on that day, and my dad sat there in his white Onslow vest, peeking over his glass, reading his paper. And I sat on my mum's knee, and I just saw this uncomfortable look in her eye. This look of pain, I'd never really seen it before. I'd always seen my mum as sort of a hero, even when she had breast cancer and stuff like that. It was always, she always soldiered on through. She was from that generation, but she had these genuine tears in her eyes. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "You know, we love you, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, well, you know, we love you so much that we adopted you. You weren't our real son. You were only fostered. But you're all, we've ever known, really, and that you've ever known, because we took you on when you were 18 months old and mum couldn't look after you. So, you know, we wanted to give you a life and we wanted you to be our son. And I guess for most people, that would be great.
Sure.
But for me, that's when the light went out. And it gave me this fear of loss, this genuine grief. I, you know, 8 years old, and I'm having an existential crisis.
And this was the first time you'd heard that you were adopted?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
You know, I had family around me from, you know, like me Nana and stuff, and they weren't ever quiet around me, not really, but nobody ever really told me until I was eight. I think it was a court order thing that I had to tell me when my adoption came. But
so what did that do to you, Jack inside? You know that
it broke me. It gave me this, like I said, it gave me an existential crisis at eight, and I didn't know who I was. So I guess the way that I started to deal with it was that I would create these worlds, these things in my head. I would create these different people. I because I thought, I'm not me. So if I'm not me, I can be anybody I want. So I would wear all these different sorts of masks. And I would become almost on the verge of multiple personality. My lying became like pretty much second nature, and it was over the silliest little things, but it's the way that I dealt with it, and I never knew any other way. I couldn't write it down because I was dyslexic in a time where dyslexia wasn't really looked at. So I had what they said was obvious learning difficulties. I couldn't manage I'm basically managed middle school, getting through being a joker and getting bullied, and I've managed 1 year of high school without being able to read and write properly, and then they put me into the special school system. We could say just thought I was thick, but I wasn't. I had this brain. I've always had this way for words and being able to spot and pick out tones and patterns and things like that in words, and you know, that's why I really identified with poetry above everything else. I was always a little performer. I was good at mimicking people and doing accents and mimicking their body language. And so, you know, the natural progression of that was that I got into like crime, you know, quite early on in my sort of criminal career.
How did you get into that? You were mimicking people, but how did you get into that? You were in a special school. You were with these adoptive parents. How did that come about?
Okay, so the special school system in the 90s, 80s and 90s, I left in 93. So you're talking, I went there in 89. It was a system that rewarded bad behaviour with good things. Like, so if you were naughty, which a lot of these kids were, which I was, because, you know, you use naughtiness to mask these inadequacies that you have, not being able to do things or being told you're not able to do these things. So you would go away on things like the Army Youth Team for the weekend. We'd spend most weekends climbing and caving through the Yorkshire Dales and moors. You know, but the thing was that this was a system that was rigged against the student and more rigged for the teachers and social workers. And it was obvious that I had these mental health problems even then. You know, I had this divergent mind, which I now know to be some form of autism, you know, an ADHD, but that, you know, there wasn't any labels on it. But these, so I lied, and there was, you know, daft, stupid lies that couldn't even be true. But it's the way that I dealt with these things by creating these stories, these worlds. But the school that I went to was in a town that was deeply affected by the mines closing, a town called Pontefract.
Yeah.
And the school is pretty much a mile to any town, you know, or less than a mile to any town in any direction. So I'd worked out, I'd gotten to know some of the local wrong-uns, really, some of the local dealers, and I was quite good at, as you can see, I'm really into VHS. I was always into VHS. I learned very quickly how to copy VHS, even get past sort of copyright protections from, you know, from the video shops and stuff like that. So I was making money by knocking off these VHS, going to the cinema with a camera, camcorder back in the days before they had all this protection, setting it up, doing these cam copies, and, you know, and at dinner I was doing this on a dinner time, and, you know, the only thing I was really good at school was I could run fast and I could run far. I was on the cross country team at county level.
Yeah.
So I would deliver drugs and like cannabis and stuff like that, tapes. You know, I used to make money by doing the top 40 on a Sunday, taking out all the adverts and stuff like that. And I just had all these ways of making money. I was working a paper round, and I was working in a key cutting shop on a Saturday at times, and I was also doing a milk round. So money was always one for me. I was always making money. I was brought up with that work ethic. But there was still something wrong in my mind. And, you know, I just kept getting further and further into this criminality.
Good.
It just got worse and worse and worse from there. And I didn't know how to handle this. I would do drugs at school. I would drink at school. The teachers would, some of the teachers, some of the adults would, you know, wouldn't say anything about it. As long as they were being sexually gratified, they were fine. You know, and it was just... So by the time I was 15, I was already in certain anonymous programs, going to certain anonymous meetings. And some of the adults there were connected with the adults at the school. So I was just being passed around from pillar as a sex doll. And I kept this deep buried in my mind for a long time. So drugs became the natural progression of...
Black it out.
Yeah, a drink and drugs. And, you know, I'm an addict. So drugs aren't my problem, they're my solution. Yeah. Drugs are the way that I disconnect from the world. And that's what I did, and that's what I did for a long time. And it, you know, it led me into sort of a few darker years. I lost my best friend to suicide. He threw himself in front of a train in front of me. I watched... You know, 18, 19, I'm watching people die of heroin overdoses because the heroin was so strong that came in from, you know, down from Scotland and things like that. I had a best friend that died, you know, he's like a big brother. He got me clean for the first time, locked me in his spare room and sat there and just held me while I screamed for 4 days. He was a giant bear of a man. He really sort of nurtured my poetic side, and you know, he would take me to these, you know, poetry performances, and we would go and I would perform my poetry, and I got to perform in front of people like Carl Dallas. He became a mentor for me for a while, and he was a good man. We lost him a couple of years ago, I believe, as well. You know, Adrian Plass, you know, and people like that.
Yeah.
Philip Glass. I had this brain. I always had this brain. You know, some people look at a wall or they look at the sky and they just see the wall and the sky. I want to write across it. That's how I've always been. It's always been that I need to fill this space with something.
Yeah.
But I became really quite prevalent in the, like I said, in the hustling scene, working as a long con man from Leeds, working with some quite notorious people. And then I got out, I had a friend called Lisa, and she lived in Portsmouth, and I went to live with her for a while after I got out of prison, because I lost it all. I lost everything. I was quite mild-mannered and meek, but I was in a nightclub one night, and this guy was hitting his missus, and there's one thing that I was always brought up to believe, that you don't hit a woman. And I lost my temper, and him and his mates went outside, and me and my mates went outside, and I got caught stamping on his head. And it's the only time I ever lost my temper, really, to the point where I nearly killed someone. And I still have some things in there that, you know, in my mind, that, you know, that it's not guilt and shame so much anymore. It was for a long time, but just I remember the person that I was. So I'm in Portsmouth. I've been doing.
So you were then put into prison.
Yeah.
And did you go into rehab again in prison, or how did that work?
Yeah. So I had some form of rehab in prison, but it's so easy to get, or was so easy to get drugs in prison, that if you wanted to do it anyway. But I wanted to learn to read and write. Darren always said to me, my best friend, he always said to me, if you could read and write, you'd be dangerous. I learned. I didn't do anything with it. I had these poems that I could now write down.
Yeah.
But that was it. I spent a lot of time in there. Prison's not for me. I wasn't a serial offender. I was a serial offender. I just never got caught for a lot of stuff. I'm very lucky in that way, but I swore I'd never go back, and I never have to date. But I got out. I was a little clean, and then I got back on the drink and stuff, and I went backwards and forwards on that for a while. And then I got involved with this thing called the Cranstone Project in Portsmouth.
Right. So you moved in with Lisa when you came out of prison?
Yeah, I moved into Lisa's flat when I came out in Portsmouth.
You still had the drink and drug problem, but you
weren't. Yeah, I mean, it drinking socially again, and then, you know, because you always think you can do it again. So I'd started drinking socially again, and then, you know, it got back onto the weed, and then that leads you on to everything else.
Yeah.
So I was on the mess again, and then I got involved with the Cranston Project over in Portsmouth and Southsea and Gosport. And they had this sort of these day programs, and I would go on these day programs. And then one of the workers there had a brother that worked on films. Knowing that I had a passion for film, I've always had a passion for film, and said, if you get to 30 days clean, I'll take you to a film set.
Right.
And I did. I got 30 days clean, took me to a film set, and I fell in love with the life.
Yeah.
And then I got involved with the Prince's Trust, and I became part of Team 22 on the Prince's Trust, and I got a job working at the Wedgwood Rooms as a comedy club magician, working because I've always loved magic. That was a good part of being a hustler. I was learning to be a sound technician, and things were going great. Then I met my first wife, who lived in Norwich, and I moved to Norfolk.
Wow.
In 2001. That's, I think I was around about 6 months, 7 months clean at that time, and I stayed clean for 10 years, 11 years, nearly 12 years.
Wow.
My marriage ended. I was hyper focusing on trying to get into the film industry. I'd written a script that was loosely based on my life. Some people liked it, some producers liked it. So I was traveling the country, meeting with these celebrities, started drinking with them. Then it led to doing the lines of coke again. And then soon enough, I found myself back on my backside, I lost, you know, pretty much everything. And I ended up homeless on the streets of Norwich, addicted to crack cocaine. I became everything that I said that I would never become. You know, some nights I was lucky enough to be able to sleep on someone's sofa. There was a guy that I was sort of, you know, I had a spare room at his house, and you know, I was living there for a while, but he was really bad on the dope as it was. Mm-hmm. So we clashed, and it was somewhere to have my daughter on a weekend, which was great. But
yeah, I was going to ask, do you have children at this point, Jack?
Yeah, and my daughter was only about four or five at the time, and there's police kicking in the door in the middle of the night trying to get to my housemate. So, you know, most of the time I would either sleep on someone's sofa or I would sleep in the trap doorway of HMV.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've been going to a local food bank on Friday morning that did a coffee morning. And one morning I turned up there, and this lovely woman, I had a Doctor Who t-shirt on, and there was this lovely woman behind the counter, and she said to me, "I love your t-shirt, I love Doctor Who." And I said, "Yeah, I love Doctor Who." And we got talking. She had this little baby, like 3 months old, and you know, her husband had left her, you know, quite a while ago. But then he came back, and they had a one night stand, and then he left her again, and really left her in the lurch. And we started talking, and I had to go home for a funeral. Not long after we'd been talking, I'd lost an uncle and an auntie quite close together. And then I found myself, 26th of June 2014, I found myself sat in a crack house, 10 o'clock at night, huge great pipe crack in my hand. And I'd had enough, and I said, "God, just, if you exist, I don't even know if you exist anymore, but if you exist, please take away this hunger, this thirst for drugs, because I can't do it. And if you don't want to take away this hunger first, then take my life, because I can't live like this anymore."
Right. Oof.
And
very
low
point.
And I fell asleep.
Mm.
On crack cocaine, which is pretty much impossible to do, but I fell asleep.
Right.
And I woke up at somewhere between 2 and 4 minutes past 12 on the 27th of June 2014, and I haven't used the day since.
Wow.
What do you think happened then?
God happened. He heard me. I always used to think that people used to tell me when I used to go into churches, God never gives you more than you can handle.
Right.
Yeah, there are some people that seem to get things put on them over and over and over again. And I always felt like a person battling mental illness, addiction, trauma. And, you know, but he does, because we learn to rely on him more and on ourselves less. And I needed to surrender my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And you know, I'm not going to turn this into a religious thing by any means, but that is what happened for me. And I had him in my life, and it was great, but I kept it at a distance because, you know, I still wanted to be a bit naughty, and, you know, I still wanted to keep one foot in that criminality. I was good at fighting. I was good at taking punches. I was, you know, I was good at grifting and stuff like that. So I would get through. I'd had relationships with women, different women. I never knew how to, even when I was married, you know, I always had this thirst for women, and it was because I never knew how to treat people right. I always thought, you know, I was all right, but I wasn't, because I treated people for that, you know, what I could get from them. So I would bounce from relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship. Addicted to sex, addicted to pornography, you know. So I'd exchange this one addiction to another.
Yeah.
it hurt people. Some people still haven't recovered from it, and I try to make amends. There are some people that will never speak with me again. There are some people that I've lost. But, you know, sex was the only thing that I knew that I could, that would make me feel loved.
Mm.
I wanted it, Lee. I lost relationships on relationships. I'd written this play, this film that I'd written. In a moment of madness, I'd gotten drunk and I'd signed it away. Accidentally, I was told that, you know, to, it, because we were making the film ourselves, and you know, I was told by this one producer, you need to sign this actor's release because you're in it. And I signed the whole film away for 4 years. So I lost that. I lost my life work time.
Yeah.
Everybody was just ganging up against me, and I hated it. I hated it. I wanted to die. I tried to kill myself. I'd gotten hold of a gun and I was going to blow my brains out, and the gun jammed twice. And it was, I'd just fallen into this.
Yeah.
This life, and, you know, meeting Jo, who's now my wife.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, we got married in 2019. You know, she helped me. She always said that she saw the man that I could be and not the monster that other people saw, because other people saw me as a monster. You know, my older children saw me as a bit of a violent monster.
Yeah.
Because I just had all this rage. I had all this rage. I didn't know how to get rid of it.
How did you meet Jo?
How did I meet Jo? So Jo was the woman at the food bank who served me, and you know, we became friends.
Right. Okay.
Despite being told by the other workers there not to, she took me out for a meal. She bought me, food and tobacco, and you know, bought me food for you know my backpack and the cupboard and stuff. And you know, she just showed me that little bit of love, and I guess that was one of the reasons that I started mulling things over in that crack house, because she saw me for who she saw me for the man that I am now and not the man that I was back then. So yeah, I ended up clean, and we got together in the September, I guess. And things were great. I was going to church. I had God in my life. I couldn't quite accept Jesus into my life because I still wanted to be a bit naughty. So if you accept Jesus into your life, then you've got to be good, haven't you?
Yeah.
So, you know, not that I wanted to be naughty, but I wanted that option to be a bit naughty, a bit criminal, so I could get away with things.
Wow.
And it was great until February 2015. Now, this is the part where I start getting sort of reminiscent. This is never the easiest time of year for me, because this is a time when I lost everything about me for a long time. I'd been ill for weeks. I'd had this cough. I was so stubborn I wouldn't go to the doctors. I would get this almighty pain in my solar plexus. I'd battled cancer two or three times and beat it. But I thought that I was going to die, and I'd had this cough, and I was just preparing myself, but I didn't want to go to the doctors. Ended up in hospital in early February, and I had a twisted gut, but they couldn't see any reason for this cough. All they could see was a little bit of scarring on my lungs, but that was put down to being a crack smoker. And then the end of February, I ended up back in hospital again for a few days.
Yeah.
And they really couldn't find out what was wrong, but I was in absolute agony. I couldn't eat without it feeling like there was a fist in my solar plexus. When I got out, and, you know, I was just back and forward to the doctors and to the hospital. And then on March the 9th, 2015, I'd been ill all week. I'd had this cough. I was shaking so hard that I would leave the bed at times. I was surviving on prayer and paracetamol. I hadn't eaten for days. I was around about 8 stone. I'm 6'1", by the way. And yeah, I was just so ill. And I could, the Saturday morning, I woke up and I felt really bad. And I managed to get some paracetamol down. And then I started feeling a lot better. But to say that before you die, about to die, you start to feel better, you get this new, and I felt great. Managed a bacon sandwich, managed coffee. I took the kids out for, you know, 5 kids in tow. A few of them under 5, 6, to a coffee shop, and we had bacon sandwiches and cake, and it was great. And then the Saturday night, I started feeling really, really rough. Sunday morning, I woke up. I hadn't had any sleep really. I could barely breathe. Every time I did breathe, it felt like I was inhaling metal, inhaling silver. And I rang my ex-wife and said, "Look, I'm going to have to call an ambulance. Can you come and get our daughter?" She said, "Well, I'll come and get you both. Don't call an ambulance. I'll come and get you both. Mm-hmm. I'll pick her up. She can see you get out of the hospital. She can give you a cuddle. You can tell her that you love her, and you can go get sorted." And I'm like, "Yeah, right, okay." So I got there around about 4:30. By 7:30, I was dead.
Really?
Physically dead. 4 minutes. I'd stopped breathing.
Your heart had stopped.
My heart had stopped. I'd stopped breathing. I had type 2 lung failure. Tuberculosis, pleurisy, some environmental disease that I hadn't seen in about 60 years. And this is all because of the life that I'd led. I had these almighty cankers in my mouth. I couldn't eat, I couldn't drink. I went to Wybill, I went to hell for 4 minutes, what felt like months. That's a whole other story. But when I came out of it, I became convinced that I'd caused the apocalypse with this super virulent strain of tuberculosis, and people were dying outside my door. I believed I was being tortured, force-fed my own dirty blood, and I became severely mentally ill. I wouldn't eat. At my lowest, I was 6 stone, 6 ounces.
Yeah.
I lost 50%. I was in what's called a negative pressure room, which is a room that it pulls all of the environmental bugs and things, it pulls it all out and pumps in clean air. But the problem is that the only...
You were in hospital all this time. Yeah.
The only time I would see people, they would be in pretty much full contagion.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's me, I caught this.
Yeah.
Thing, and this happened for weeks and weeks. They wanted to section me while I was in there, trying to make me eat. I couldn't eat. I couldn't drink. And it was really, really dark for weeks. And then I suppose mid-April, I'm laying there, and I had this, through the whole thing, there was this kind of figure at the end of my bed. And, you know, when I believed that I went to hell, it wasn't like that. It wasn't judgmental. It was just this presence at the end of this bed. And I said, "Look, who are you?" And he went, "You know who I am." I went, "Well, what have I got to do?" "You know what you got to do." And I went, "God, I can't handle this no more. I accept you into my life." And like that, it was like, it was miraculous. I can't describe it as anything else.
Yeah, it sounds like that.
One of the nurses, the head nurse actually, that was looking out, is now one of my best friends. She walked in, and I was sat up in bed, which was pretty much impossible. I couldn't eat, couldn't drink, couldn't wash myself, couldn't do anything. When anybody tried to come near me, I would scream, I would shout, I would spit. My friend, who's the pastor of our church, had come to pray for my soul because they were going to lose me again. And there I am. I just accepted Jesus into my life, and I'm sat the bed, and she walked in, and I go, can I have a wash, please? And she was like,
yeah.
And she ran out, and the doctors came in, and they're checking me, and they're like, you should not be set up. And I'm like, what? You're talking? I'm like, yeah. Because you know, apart from the rage, I wouldn't speak. I was pretty much mute. And I was talking, and I said I was hungry, and they brought me jelly, and I managed that, and it was nothing short of miraculous. I managed this one. They gave me this one drug that I had this adverse reaction to, and I got this. It gave me an instant rash from here to basically my just under my belly.
Gosh,
and it was literally like somebody had put acid on my stomach, and that's what it felt like. It was burning, it was itchy, it was sore, and it hurt really, really badly. And I still had it, but I'm sat there and I'm washing myself. As I'm washing myself, this rash is just disappearing underneath the sponge. You know, and this is why I laugh when people tell me there's no such thing as miracles. I know there's things as miracles. I've seen it. I've seen a rash just, you know, a burning rash just disappear under nothing but water and a sponge. They couldn't quite believe it. There were people coming in, and they were bringing me in sweets and bottles of Lucozade, because that's a good northern thing to do. knowing that I like Lucozade, I mean. They were bringing me in tins of Spam.
Yeah.
And there's nothing better than the smell of cooking Spam on a ward, and listening to people in the ward next door going, this is cooking Spam. Yeah, they're cooking it for me. Because they said that if I managed to get up to 8 stone, I could live.
Wow.
It was coming up to the eldest boy's birthday, and I wanted to get out. I'd been made redundant while I was in hospital. I'd had a job, and they'd gone bust. So I got made redundant when I was in hospital, and I got £200 in severance. And as soon as they said, you can leave as soon as you get to 8 stone, I decided that I was going to eat my way out. So they were bringing me in breakfast, and I would have their breakfast, and then an hour later I would go down to the canteen and have another. Same with lunch. Same with tea. And then supper times, a local pizza place would do two 14-inch pizzas for the price of one. So I would order that pretty much every night. I would have one pizza, and the nurses would share another.
So you had this plan that you were going to reach 8 stone so you could get out. Had you thought any further than getting out? What was going to happen then?
No, I knew I wasn't the man that went in.
No.
I knew I wasn't the man that went in. I knew.
No.
I knew I was different. I knew I'd been reborn.
Yeah.
There were still some behaviours there that needed looking at. There were still some behaviours there that not only needed looking at, but they needed dealing with.
Yes.
Like some of the past traumas. But I couldn't see past wanting to get out. I just wanted to get out. I wanted to be with the kids. I wanted to be with a wife. And
they wanted you back.
They wanted me back. And on that last day, I'd run out of money. I'd run out of money. And, you know, I'd managed to get my dinner downstairs, but that was it. And then, you know, Nurse Jackie came in, the head nurse, and she went, you know what, Jack, we absolutely love you. We've seen you go from this absolute mess to this absolute warrior, and we want to thank you for all that you've done for us. You know, you've kept us fed every night, and they paid for my pizza that night, which really sort of touched me. And yeah, I was on the last day, and I got out, and just I concentrated on getting weight on. Incidentally, it took me 2 weeks to get from 6 stone 6 to 8 stone 4.
Wow.
So your mindset was different. Did you really feel you'd been given that, you know, a chance and a second chance, a new life, you know, really?
Third chance, fourth chance, whatever it was.
Fourth chance, yeah.
It was.
But this was a huge moment for you, though.
Yeah, but I had come out different. I came out with a different mindset.
Yeah.
I came out with this want to know, actually, who is Jack?
Yeah.
Who am I? What I call myself, what I was, is a hooligan, W-H-O-ligan.
Yeah.
Because it all came from not knowing who I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I found out about sonship and what that's like within the church setting. And, you know, I have spiritual father figures that I love very much. I have a relationship with my, my adoptive parents. I had a relationship with my mum until my biological mum until I lost her in 2017. Also in 2017, 2 months after we lost my mum, I lost my 2-day-old niece because her father beat her to death. And that was a dark time as well, but I never went back to drugs. He was sentenced to life with a minimum of 10 years. He served less than a year and then was murdered by his cellmate, who was a rapist. And there are people out there that say, oh, that's karma, that's godly. That it's not. It's not. He was a 22-year-old lad that lost his temper, paid the price. I hated him. I hated his mum. I hated his family. But I was in this church and I'd been baptized. I'd become an active member of the church. One of the leaders of the church took a year for the funeral. But one of the leaders of the church took me and I came out of the funeral and I back in the days when I smoked and I lit a cigarette and his mum walked up to me and she put her arms around me and she said, thank you for coming. And I broke. I absolutely broke. Now, Chris is a very stoic man, the one of the leaders of the church, and we went and sat in his car and he said, what's going on? And I was hit with this realization, this calmness that you only get through pain, through violence. You know when you're screaming and shouting and you punch something and then you know you've done something really bad because you just go quiet and calm. Or when you stub your toe so hard, you just go quiet and calm. That's what happened. And I was sat in the car and he said, what's going on? And I said, I need to forgive him. He said, well, I need to. God's telling me I need to forgive him. Oh, that doesn't mean forget. That doesn't mean forget what he's done. That doesn't mean forget what his family's done. That doesn't mean, you know, what it means.
No.
That because unforgiveness is like drinking poison and expecting another person to die, it don't happen. Me hating him, what's me hating a dead man going to do? Is it going to affect him or is it going to affect me? Well, it was affecting. I knew I had to forgive him, so I went on this journey of forgiveness.
Mm.
And it opened up so much. It opened up so much.
Yeah.
It's
very hard to forgive, but it is very, as you say, cathartic to
it is.
To actually do that.
It is. It's not easy, and there are times when I still wobble. But, and then I was asked to tell a bit of my story for a book that was written by a guy. About a guy by the name of Paul Sykes, who was a world champion boxer, drank himself to death on the streets. Paul was a friend of mine. I did some debt collection with him back in the day. So I did poetry for...
So was that really the start of your writing poetry and writing your story when you wrote for Paul Sykes?
Yes. Yeah, so I wrote poems about Paul Sykes and, you know, for the guy that wrote the books.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was asked if I wanted to write my own and I wrote A Personal Apocalypse, which is the poetry that I've written through my life from various different states with explanations and then some stories in between. And I wrote that. That was released by Walker Eye Press. And then I spent 6 months working with Escape. I wanted to do another book, and I spent 6 months working with escapees of human trafficking, sexual slavery, and exploitation. And in learning their story and in spending time with them, I realized that I was trafficked.
Yeah.
I realized exactly what happened to me. Before that, I couldn't do this. I couldn't speak about it at all. Certain things I could speak about, which I did, but I couldn't speak about this at all. And I realized I was trafficked and I began to heal.
Yeah.
And by giving other people voices, they began to heal. You know, the second book, Between the Street Lights and Red Lights. And then
it's taken a long time, as you said. I mean, we've spoken to several people who said they've used drugs,
yes,
or other methods to just block their emotions. And, you know, as you said, you've done that as well. And it was only once you've accepted and realized what's happened to you that you began to deal with it, that you can begin to recover.
Yeah.
Your book, I have to say, the bits of poetry, I couldn't read it all in one go,
yeah,
which I normally do with a book. I've read bits because it is so emotional. The poems, and even just the letter that you've written in the foreword to your parents.
Yeah, I defy anyone to read that and not get to the end of it without feeling a tear there. It was in,
That was my healing. That was my healing. What I do is I tell my story in order for people not to follow the same road that I did and make the same mistakes that I did.
Or if they have, to show them that there's a way out.
There's hope.
Exactly. I mean, this is the whole point of our podcast, that it doesn't matter what's happened in the past, it can be great.
Thank you.
Well, it's been emotional, but it's been quite inspiring just listening to you. So thank you very much, and I shall read the rest of your book bit by bit,
yeah,
something I will have to do in small doses.
Thank you. It means a lot.
That was really emotional. So a big thank you to Jack for sharing his story with us, and to all our listeners, and we hope you can join us next time.
Yes, next time we will be talking to Kevin Lane, who also spent much of his life in jail. So do join us. Till then, take care.